Our guest today is the president of the Joyce Foundation. She oversees the charitable distribution of $50 million per year from assets of $1 billion. Our guest today earned her bachelor's degree in English with honors from Brown University and her MBA from Northwestern University. She is so smart, and she has with her today her mother, Pat Alberding. Well, welcome, Pat. Thank you very much, very much. And her sister, Jane McCarthy. Jane, say hi to all the City Clubbers. Okay. Her niece, what a golden name, a ballot name, Caroline McCarthy. Caroline, where are you? There we go, Caroline. Thank you. And as was mentioned, her husband, Kelly Welsh. Let's give them a round of applause. Please welcome Ellen Alberding.
Hello. Obviously, I've papered the room. I don't know why my family keeps showing up. They could hear me for free, you know, anytime, but maybe they're not sick of me yet. I don't know. It's really great to be here. I'm honored to keep being invited back. I want to really especially thank the Joyce Foundation staff members who are here today. I get up every morning hoping to do something good, and it's really so much easier when I'm surrounded by such good and talented people. So there they are, and thank you so much. I was asked to talk here today about how what we do connects to what's going on in the city, and my hope is that I can really represent the great work of the staff team as best that I can, because it's really their work and their commitment, their deep commitment to social justice that underlies all of the advances that we've had and the ideas that we have for going forward. I mean, it's really an amazing team, and I'm so deeply appreciative. As it happens, this conversation is particularly timely, given that next week something really amazing is going to happen. We will elect our first African-American woman mayor. And I just want to say it's just a remarkable step forward for our city and one that I feel really optimistic about. It's part of what's happening all over the country. You know, the winds of change are happening. We've got elected officials who represent a younger demographic, a more diverse demographic. We have folks running for office that might never have considered it before. We have young people driving change on gun violence. We have young people behind the new Green Deal, and they are shaking things up, and it's really an important change. One of the candidates said recently in one of the 10,000 candidate forums that her view is that, in part, what she's excited about is that this election means that any young person in Chicago can see themselves as a candidate, can see themselves running for something, can see themselves as leaders. And I really hope that that's true. But to make our city work better for all of our young people, particularly young people of color, we can't lay that on the mayor all by herself. It's on all of us. We hear a lot about Chicago's challenges, and there are plenty of them. But I believe that our future is bright only if we have the strength and the will to face the issues that hold us back. The pursuit of a more fair, more inclusive, and more equitable city is at the heart of our work at the Joyce Foundation. Knowing that our city and our region are becoming more diverse and skewing younger, the foundation has reoriented its grant making toward that demographic of folks. Today, young people of color make up the majority of school children across the United States. And young people of color represent 90% of the students in Chicago public schools. These young people have such great promise, but they also have such challenges. And no city embodies those challenges as much as the city of Chicago. Kathy Cohen, whom many of you may know, is a distinguished professor at the University of Chicago. She did a recent survey that gives stark evidence of the challenges for our young people. Her survey found significant differences in how young white people and young people of color experience our city. Where white young folks see opportunities, young people of color face obstacles. For example, unemployment on the north side was just 5%, while unemployment in Lawndale, 25%. And here's a striking chart. When asked if they would call the police for help if they were in trouble, look what the results were. That's a huge difference between how white young people and African-American young people respond to that question. Clearly, they are having completely different experiences. So how do we change that dynamic? Well, first of all, we have to face up to and dismantle the systems of segregation and inequity that have been persistent barriers to success for young people of color. We believe that our foundation has a responsibility to step up to help. We want to work with every business and civic leader that agrees with that and wants to work with us. And a mayor cannot do this alone. We all have to help her. We do have some ideas for the next mayor, and I'm going to be so bold as to provide them. Let's start with the kids. Chicago public school students have made incredibly impressive gains over the last number of years. Possibly you've heard about the Stanford researcher, Sean Reardon. His analysis found that CPS students are making faster gains on elementary school achievement exams than 96% of students nationwide, including every other major urban district. For an entire school system to achieve that, let alone one where 85% of the students are low income, is really nothing short of stunning. A 2018 Washington Post article on CPS's remarkable progress pointed to the hard work and persistence of our entire community in making that happen. It took data, facing up to the facts, and, as I said, persistence to make it happen. And we're pretty good at that, all of us. There are other good outcomes as well. CPS students are graduating at higher rates, going on to college, and obtaining post-secondary credentials at improved rates. And this was not always so. I have a very strong memory of visiting Von Steuben High School in the 1990s. I saw students in a basement classroom with a sort of unidentifiable green substance dripping down the walls and just a horrible odor. The teachers were demoralized, the students disengaged. The whole place just reeked of neglect. Asking young people to learn in that kind of environment bordered on criminal, and I felt ashamed. I wondered, what do these young people and what do these students think that we think of them to put them in this kind of a learning environment? But there's good news. After 30 years of reform and many, many millions of dollars invested in renovations in schools around the city, Von Steuben is now a magnet school. It offers a rigorous science curriculum. It has a 97% graduation rate. Its average SAT scores are higher than the average in the rest of the state. And that's a great triumph, and it's a good example of what's going on in our school system. But there's always a but. So, still, one in four kids doesn't earn a diploma. Only 18% of CPS graduates complete four-year college within 6 years. And low-income students and students of color continue to lag behind whiter, wealthier students in our system. We have some ideas on how to close this gap. Some of them I've talked to you about before, and they're not really news, but we think they continue to be really important. First is to increase the number of highly effective teachers. It's the single most important thing that can happen for a child is to have an effective teacher standing in front of that classroom. There are a ton of people who've worked on this issue over the years. I want to call out one who was my partner in this many years ago, Gretchen Crosby Sims, who is the one who synthesized the data and drew the attention to the importance of this issue and drove the conversation over many, many years. So, Gretchen, thank you for that. She's sitting in the back. She's pretty fabulous. The second thing we need to do is double down on our support for principals. I hate to say they're the second most important factor, but they certainly are up there with teacher quality. And again, I want to call out the Chicago Public Education Fund, which is an organization that has focused intensely on principal quality, and they've had the full cooperation of CPS over many years through many leadership changes. And again, it's a story about consistency and not letting leadership change the focus on what really counts. A third thing is to help students earn college credits and career schools while they're in high school. And that for those of us who are in high school a really long time ago, that might sound a little strange, but it's a really important trend, and there's a lot of evidence that having kids earn those college credits not only reduces their expenses when they get into college, but in many other ways causes them to graduate at higher levels. Fourth is City Colleges of Chicago. I was on that board for a number of years, and I was succeeded by Beth Swanson from the Joyce team, who's now very involved and is the vice chair of that board. You might not know it from reading the local news, but the City Colleges is one of the success stories in City Colleges around the country. As evidence of that, I'll give you a couple of items. Kennedy King College won a national award called the Rising Star Award from the Aspen Institute College Excellence Program in 2015. Our graduation rate went from 7 to 23%. Now, let's not say 23% is like our goal, but tripling the graduation rate in a short period of time is really a significant achievement. I'd also want to just note that Brian Fabes, I'm not sure he's here today, but he's a close colleague of mine from the Civic Consulting Alliance, led the first wave of reform at City Colleges. He was supported by Mayor Daley, by Mayor Emanuel, and by an incredibly strong chancellor to implement and move what is a very large and very frustratingly difficult bureaucracy toward those successes. And again, that's a story of persistence over time with strong leadership, even if it's a different leadership over time. The next mayor, it's really important for the next mayor to stick with that and stick with the good team that exists there to make things continue to work. So I never come here without talking about guns, and gun violence is really just an issue that consumes all of us who care so much about our city. I think most of you would have seen the promising downward trends in homicides and shootings in Chicago, but as a reminder, these are the numbers. Still not great, but we prefer to see it going down than up. But these are just statistics. I want to just talk about the personal toll. And I'm not going to do the talking. I want to hear from a young lady, Audrey Wright. She's a senior at North Lawndale College Prep. She gave a talk recently at an Arne Duncan event, and we've taken a few of her comments, which we can hear right now on the screen.
What is it going to take for the city to wake up and realize that if we don't do something now, the future that you all are looking for won't be there? As a daughter of Chicago, I am a survivor of the gun violence epidemic. My generation either dies before we live to see 18, or we celebrate because we have made it to seeing our 18th birthday. I graduated eighth grade with a friend who always expressed that he didn't believe he would make it to see his 18th birthday. Unfortunately, on March 7, 2018, Tony was shot and killed on his 18th birthday.
That's what young people are living with. And as long as we have young people in our community devastated by deaths, shootings, and fear, we are not going to have a healthy city. We have to do something about this. And I want to just acknowledge Pam Bosley, who's in the audience today. sitting over here, whose beautiful son, Terrell, was shot to death at age 18 in 2006 on his 18th birthday. And Pam has been a steadfast supporter of improving our gun policy. She's been a fantastic advocate, and we are so proud to have been supporting her work. I'm wearing Terrell's bracelet today. So there you go. Thank you, Pam. There's another set of statistics that I want to talk about that is related to this, and it's extremely important to understand what's going on. It's been talked about a little bit, but I'm not sure it rises how far it rises in people's attention. And that's what's called clearance rates. And clearance rates are a technical term for actually making arrest or coming to a conclusion about a crime. One recent statistic shows that less than 20% of homicides leads to an arrest. Now, for comparison's sake, New York clearance rates are 75%. LA is 74%. And we are still at 20%. No wonder people lack confidence in the police. What do we expect? The combination of the fact that gun crimes are so rarely solved and a history of overly aggressive policing tactics has created such deep mistrust between CPD and the communities it serves. This mistrust was a strong undercurrent in a study that we commissioned of young people on the South and West Sides to try to find out why are they carrying guns, given that it actually probably leads to bad outcomes for them. But the study found there were three major reasons. First, they carry guns because they themselves have been victims of gun violence in the past. They carry guns because they fear they might become a victim, given how many victims are in their lives. And third, they don't believe they'll be caught. And that's a pretty good bet, given the clearance rates that I just mentioned. So I feel, and others feel, they're forced into a false choice. They can either carry a gun to protect themselves with a relatively low risk that they'll be caught, or follow the law and rely on police whom they don't trust to protect them. It's a terrible position for them to be in. And these insights, I think, are really important to understand. To its great credit, the leadership of the Chicago Police Department does understand these issues and has taken important steps toward rebuilding trust, even though the relationship remains fragile. I'd also like to say that during their careers, both mayoral candidates have done admirable work on criminal justice and police reform. Our recommendations, which I'm going to outline just now, certainly would come as no surprise to them, and I feel optimistic that either of the candidates will adopt all or part of these recommendations. First is to support efforts to ensure police accountability. Chicago can and must transform CPD into a department that provides for the well-being and safety of its officers, but at the same time engendering the trust and support and cooperation of the community. These two goals are not mutually exclusive. They are fundamental to public safety. The current leadership of CPD, the mayor's office, and the attorney general's office all firmly believe that the newly negotiated consent decree, which everybody I'm sure has read about, can help make this a reality, and we agree. We've seen other large districts with consent decrees make this work. Los Angeles, for example, has come a long way since the Rodney King era. Several years after its consent decree was put in place, and they made many, many changes and improvements, a recent survey found that 70% of people now think that LAPD is doing an excellent or good job. Now, we haven't done a survey like that in Chicago, but I'm guessing we wouldn't be at that level just yet. I feel optimistic we can get there, though, with changes. A second recommendation is to fully fund and staff a new Office of Violence Prevention in City Hall. Our current mayor made a down payment on that by putting some funding next year into a small Office of Violence Prevention, but it should be fully funded in the next administration with a top-notch team of people. It can serve as a center to coordinate all the violence reduction efforts in Chicago, which is a badly needed mission. And I don't like to always go back to New York and L.A. for our examples, but their homicide rates have come down dramatically, and each of those cities has a very well-supported office similar to this, and they do attribute a lot of their improvements to having that coordination coming out of the mayor's office. Okay, you've heard me talk about this before. We have to curb the flow of illegal guns. Chicago has a gun violence problem because Chicago has a gun program problem. We have a gun program. The city has a gun problem. But easy access to guns fuels violence. It's just not that complicated to understand. In 2018, Chicago police took almost 10,000 guns off the streets. But we have to do more than that. We have to trace every recovered gun to find and prosecute its source. We have to beef up the reporting of lost and stolen guns. And it's true, as you've probably heard, that there's a pipeline of illegal guns coming from Indiana and Mississippi and other states. But what you might not know is that 40% of Chicago's crime guns come from Illinois, in particular the suburbs. So to solve the problem, let me pause on that. 40% of crime guns are coming from our own state, which suggests that we have huge improvements to be made in our own state laws to stop that from happening. I'm going to make another shift here because we have so many issues that I want to cover. I want to talk a little bit about environmental issues, and we have some wonderful neighborhood environmental advocates sitting with us today, which I'm so proud that they were able to join us. The foundation is mostly known, I think. Our reputation in the environment has been built on our work on Great Lakes water issues, making sure that the water quality is good and improving, and we've done a lot of work on energy efficiency, particularly at the state policy level. But with our new focus on young people and young people of color, we've also started looking more deeply at the impact of environmental policy on individuals in communities. One of the great civic leaders in Chicago, somebody I have admired for many years, is Dr. Larry Goodman, who's the CEO of Rush University. He recently announced his retirement, but he has just been a great contributor. He and his team of community leaders started an organization called Westside United, which was looking at health outcomes and the disparity of health outcomes between wealthy white people in our city and poor African American and Latinos. We learned a lot from him. One thing that they found is that if you live in Chicago's mostly white loop, your life expectancy is about 85 years. If you ride the blue line three stops west to the mostly poor African-American community, your life expectancy is 69 years. So there's a 16-year gap in life expectancy depending on what neighborhood you live in our city. And that is really sort of a shocking and outrageous number. The 69-year number is the same as the life expectancy in Bangladesh, for example. And there are so many reasons for this disparity. We are not a healthcare or medical foundation. We don't have expertise in that area, but we're deeply concerned about the issue, and we looked for, like, where do we have expertise? What are the things we should be looking at there? So we decided to focus on the impact of pollution and toxins on people's health. We're still, you know, the bulk of our money is going to be going into Great Lakes issues, great water and energy efficiency, but we were beginning to expand our grant making in that arena. And the fact is, what we have found is that Chicago's planning process over decades has located industrial developments in poorer communities that were not in a position to voice objections about the plans. These environmental health hazards are now located in neighborhoods with very large numbers of young people of color. The map behind me was created by NRDC, which is a leading environmental group. Basically, it shows that low-income communities of color have much more exposure to pollution and toxins than wealthier and whiter areas of the city. We want to work with the next mayor to help better understand and address these issues, and that includes creating fairer and more inclusive zoning and planning processes that include a community voice and put public health first. Of course, we understand that there are jobs and economic development imperatives, but we can't ignore the health issues and the disparate impacts on low-income people and people of color. Finally, I'll talk a little bit about our arts and culture program. Chicago had 60 million visitors last year. I think it was due in some large part to our world-class art and creative sector. The arts give agency to a community. They allow people to define their own narratives, to celebrate the richness of their lives, to preserve their culture. But like so many other sectors, the arts community has its own built-in biases. For many people on Chicago's south and west sides, the art world is not accessible. In some communities, there are few, if any, arts organizations or performance venues. Yeah, it's important and fantastic for school children to visit our great lakefront museums. I remember well at the time that I worked at the Chicago Children's Museum and saw the excitement of young children visiting Navy Pier. For some of them, amazingly, it was their first glimpse of the lake, and the programs at the museum were and are just first rate. But that's not enough. Access for all is key. So we are deeply committed to supporting arts organizations based in communities, to funding artists of color, and to diversifying the leadership of arts organizations in our city. I love Chicago. I'm sure all of you in this room share a hope for a better Chicago and a promising future for our young people. It's going to take safer communities, stronger schools, a healthier environment, and greater avenues for cultural expression. And I think it's all possible. But our next mayor is going to walk into a heap of trouble on her very first day. She's going to need our help. I really do like saying she. It's really great. And we're lucky to have a city with such a great tradition of all of us working together to solve big problems. So here's my commitment, and I hope everyone in this room will join. I have a feeling you will. Keep caring about our city. Keep answering the call to help. Keep being an advocate and an ally, and remember to add a seat at the table so that new voices can be part of the conversation. I have one last thing. Last year, I told you about the Partnership for Safe and Peaceful Communities, in which 40 philanthropic organizations have joined together to fund significant job training and violence reduction programs. Among other things, we made grants to grassroots groups for summer programs on the ground in communities to make them safer. I'd like to leave you with a video that talks a little bit about what happened there and I think gives us some help going forward. And I'd particularly like to thank FCB, the advertising agency, for producing this video for us, which they put a lot of time and effort into. So thank you for your attention, and I hope you enjoyed this short video.
The neighborhood I grew up in, it's six blocks, two blocks long. Everybody knows each other. Everybody's close to each other. Kids from my area, we don't leave the neighborhood. We all we got.
I was at work one day and having lunch with ladies, and there were four of us at a table, and three of us had lost a child to gun violence. Three out of four.
I think people are banging their heads against the wall trying to figure out what is causing all of this violence in the city of Chicago. People are frustrated. People are trying to figure out ways to even just stop it on their block.
How can we empower them to create a better experience in their own community? Instead of doing things for people, to do things with people, because the people who you're trying to quote-unquote help, they are the ones that need to be empowered to lead themselves. Every week, I'm somewhere with someone who's making a difference.
I think it's important for young people in general to see leaders and people who look like them that they didn't imagine would be in roles that they're in. It's true, you can't be what you can't see. So if you're not exposed to it, how do you even know it exists?
I see small organizations. I see people coming together and really believing that they can be a force for change. Things are changing in this community. People are changing. The minds of the people are changing.
And that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
Do you need water?
I'm good. Okay. I'll give you guys another last chance to get your card in because the bowl didn't get all the way around, I understand. And if there are questions, please get them on up. Sarah's over in the corner. No questions? Okay, just a couple. There are a couple of people that we didn't see. I saw him, but didn't realize that we did not recognize him, and that's Mr. David Hiller. And Mr. Don Cook. Is he here too? Oh, there's Don. I had a great time sitting in there. A lot of fun. Kelly, I didn't know you had such fun friends. So I'll get right in with the questions, and I do like saying she, too. That's pretty cool,
that's
isn't
good.
It, Ellen?
That's good.
I think so. So let's just start right out of the box with Susanna Malik McKenna. Is the company called Contexos?
Yes.
I said it right? Good. Okay. What does a fully funded Office of Violence Prevention look like? Does it include integration with huge community challenges of housing, jobs, public health, et cetera?
Well, it's not up to me to tell the mayor how that should be organized, but I will tell you that in L.A. they have hundreds of people in the office, and I think similarly in New York. And their mission is to synthesize all of, and coordinate all of the activities in the city, whether it's in housing, whether it's at CPD, whether it's in social services, all of which that can contribute to reducing violence, and that. That should be the mission, but I think there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. But the key thing that's missing is a centralized citywide anti-violence strategy that has everybody at the table. So that's the concept, but it has to be built out by the mayor and her team.
So this is more a comment. Muriel Schabo from the Archdiocese, is she here? Okay, she just says thank you for the. For the funding that you all have given them.
Well, you're welcome to everybody.
My mother always says thank you is important. So how many in the room are givers, as in philanthropic givers, grant givers? Oh, you're so shy. So how many of you guys are recipients of... See, their hands are up high, see? All right. Just wanted you to kind of see who's in there.
I got that.
So, so Chandra Richardson, are you here from Sunshine Enterprises? Oh, there she is. Okay. She says, given the evolution of public policy and our economy, what is a way the philanthropic sector can give better support, civic engagement anyway? It's kind of a tough question.
Well, I think that's a great question. And civic engagement is a part of another. I couldn't do all our programs; I'd really drive everyone nuts. But we have a whole program called Democracy, and its focus is completely on civic engagement. So we're funding work on the census, which I didn't touch on, but making sure we have a complete count. And that's a way of engaging civically, is participating in the census. We saw really, really strong and positive turnout among young people at the midterm elections. So we would like to build on that. The turnout in the mayoral was considerably lower, but, I don't know what the reasons for that would be. But we're funding Chicago Votes. I think they're here today, as well as other organizations whose mission is to get people to engage civically. We're funding a lot of neighborhood-based news organizations that are talking about how issues are affecting communities. It's sort of bottom-up reporting, which I think is critical. You'll notice that I didn't have an opportunity to quote the big newspapers in town about any of our issues. But I think some of these smaller organizations are really important to the dialogue. I know that the McCormick Foundation, David Hiller, is a leader on civics education in the state. So there's a lot of ways to get at that. But bottom line, your question is one that's really, really important, because we can't have a healthy democracy. We can't have a healthy city if people feel cynical or disengaged. And so figuring out ways to change that dynamic, I think, is critically important. And obviously, it's not just something that is a problem in Chicago. It's a nationwide concern. I did mention, though, the Parkland kids and the young people who are involved in the new Green Deal. I met yesterday with the head of a very, very large, long-time, old-line environmental group, and he said, "These kids, where did they come from?" You know, he's bemoaning it a little bit, but what he concluded with was, "Why didn't I get to them first?" And I think, you know, people are waking up and smelling the coffee about where change is coming from, and it is from a younger and much more diverse set of voices. So encouraging that is a top priority.
So just a couple more questions. Dwayne, Dustin, the federal prosecutor, I didn't see you today. I know you're here somewhere, because he wouldn't have written the question if he...
He's in the back.
Oh, there he is. Okay. He's a former federal prosecutor, and he is a city club member. What has held Chicago... You talked about this a little bit, but I'm going to ask you to expound. What has held Chicago back for decades of reductions of violence seen in such cities as New York and Los Angeles?
That's just such a people have written dissertations about it. It's just such a complicated question, and I don't want to put my finger on any particular item. I do think that the consent decree has highlighted improvements that should be made in the Chicago Police Department that will right some of those wrongs. I do think that both New York and LA have had much more innovative approaches and much more coordinated approaches to violence reduction, and you see the result. But also, you know, we know from many decades of work on this that it's very hard to say what causes downturns and upturns in violence. So that's a weak answer, but I'm not sure I can really give you a solid one and done on that one.
I would say less a weak answer, but more a perplexing situation that Chicago's been in for a very, very long time. So,
you should be my spin meister.
So, Jackie Davidoff is here. Where are you, Jackie? She's here somewhere. Okay. You guys know if I don't see you, I oftentimes don't ask your question. Jackie, this is a... I don't. this is a environmental question. Jackie's with Mission Driven Strategies. In terms of factors that adversely and disproportionately affect the health and individuals of living in communities of color, there was a story in WBEZ about the massive amounts of toxins coming from Amazon and other companies' warehouses located in these communities and organizations. Have you tracked the disproportionate levels of diesel trucks coming into the communities, and is there any discussion around this? The question, Jeff.
I believe the tracking has occurred. Elizabeth Caesar on our team is deeply involved in that. I think that's another one of these complex issues, because we don't want to, you know, choke off economic growth and job growth. At the same time, you can't be developing, whether it's an Amazon factory or whatever, you can't be developing things in a way that harm the local community, and there's, you know, and they have no voice and no opportunity to have input. So that's, I think, what we're interested in is that, you know, the economic growth and the job growth argument is well articulated. It's really powerful. It's something we really need. But we need to make sure, and what Joyce Foundation is trying to do, is make sure that the voice of the communities is part of the conversation. So, folks should not be brushed off as not mattering because they're low-income people or people of color. They do matter. Their health matters. And, you know, the data does exist. But the conversation needs to be on a more even plane. That's our view on it, and that's why we're supporting the organizations that we are supporting. Now, I don't want to exaggerate what we're doing. We're just getting our toe in the water. We're beginning to expand our interests. And as I say, Elizabeth Caesar is leading that on our team and just doing a very, very careful, data-driven set of recommendations for our board. So, I mean, that's more than you asked for there, but it's an important question.
Perry Ermer is here. I saw her earlier. There she is. So she says thank you for the support of the Joyce Foundation through a planning grant that will enable the oldest independent black museum, which is the DuSable, to become full accreditation with your it's going to become fully accredited with your support through the arts. So do you want to comment on that?
I really want to comment on that. So... DuSable is such an important institution. It has a wonderful collection. It has a spectacular building and a great location. And now we have Perry Ermer just leading the charge toward getting accreditation for that museum. Now, if you don't know much about the museum world, having accreditation is a major, major, major step. It's not easy to achieve. You have to prove that you know how to manage your collection. You need, you know, you can keep the heating and temperature correct. You've got the right sort of curators. I mean, it's this massive project. And Perry just and I were just talking about the team that she's put together to help her do this. It's a very, very significant thing. Tracy Hall, where's Tracy? Tracy. There she is. Tracy Hall on our team has been the one who has so patiently participated in the process and so effectively persuaded me and our board about not only the importance of it, which is obvious, but how we can really be a constructive participant in it. So I am thrilled and excited and, you know, wish you the best. And I hope that next time I come back and talk, I can say, and they got it.
DuSable is a pretty awesome place to be. Colin Moore, are you here? I'm glad you waved your hand because you're almost going to get a question. He's from Trilogy Behavioral Healthcare. Does Joyce work with ancillary issues surrounding gun violence, yes, i.e. peer education and PTSD and trauma-based treatment and violence prevention for young people on the southwest sides? Is that right? Is that what you're saying? Okay, south and west sides.
So the Joyce Foundation is a policy-oriented foundation, so you'll hear us talk about state and federal policy and local policy as being the levers that we choose to focus on. But there is no doubt a whole range of social services that need to be attended to, and it's an issue that we participate in and occasionally do grant-making in that world, but we don't fund direct service organizations, so if that was a pitch, you know. but one of the things that you give me a little room to raise is the important question of suicide and suicide prevention and mental health interventions. Something like 60% or 65% of gun deaths in the United States are suicides. They're not homicides. And there's so much evidence, much of which we have funded, that proximity to a gun is very closely related to the completion of a suicide attempt or a death in a suicide attempt, particularly among young people who might have a moment of despair. There's a gun under dad's desk. And, you know, the proximity of the gun causes the young person to kill himself. We recently had the terrible news of two of the Parkland high school students, or one who just graduated, committed suicide, as well as one of the dads of the six-year-olds who was murdered in Connecticut. The two students, both committed suicide with a gun. And it's a very current issue for us. And it's something that we have tried very hard to work with the suicide prevention community as part of our allies to reduce access reduce access to guns because it will reduce gun death. So thanks for raising it, and you probably know 20 times more than I do about the issue, but it's something we think about a lot. So thank you.